It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. I want to start with an update to a story we talked about this time yesterday related to this week's school shooting in Florida. We shared information from the Anti-Defamation League saying that a leader of a white nationalist group in Florida had claimed that the perpetrator had trained with his organization. The same person made the same claim to media organizations as well, including the Associated Press and the Daily Beast. Since yesterday's show, the white nationalist group leader has walked back that claim, and journalists and law enforcement were unable to confirm a connection between the perpetrator and that organization. Now, after weeks of negotiations aimed at reaching a bipartisan deal on immigration, progress came to a screeching halt yesterday in Congress after four different proposals in the Senate were rejected, with the most promising deal failing to get 60 votes after a veto threat came in from President Trump. That means that, among other things, lawmakers are left without a fix for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, and no clear path forward on comprehensive immigration reform. All sides are now assigning blame. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell expressing his displeasure with his Democratic colleagues.
I was hoping we could reach a bipartisan solution that could pass the Senate, pass the House, and earn President Trump's signature. But once again, when the hour came to actually make law, instead of just making political points, our friends across the aisle were either unable or unwilling to get something done.
And here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer with harsh words for President Trump.
Immigration's always a contentious issue. There are intense feelings on both sides of the aisle. If there was ever a time for presidential leadership, this was it. President Trump has failed this test of leadership spectacularly.
So what went wrong in the immigration debate? And with no compromise in sight and a quickly approaching March 5th deadline for Congress to take action on DACA, can lawmakers still get something done? Karthik Ramakrishnan is a professor of public policy and political science at the University of California, Riverside, where he serves as associate dean of the School of Public Policy. Karthik, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we'll get into some of the details in a bit, but in a nutshell, what went wrong in the Senate yesterday with four different proposals coming to a vote, none of them getting the 60 votes they needed?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to take a step back and see why we're here in the first place. So the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was implemented by President Obama, and it's been a program that renews these work authorizations every couple of years for people who meet a stringent set of standards in terms of either being in school or having graduated from high school and meeting a rigid set of criteria, not getting in trouble with the law, et cetera. President Trump announced in September that he would be ending the program starting March 5th. And so in many ways, that's what has triggered this anxiety, not just in Congress, but for hundreds of thousands of immigrants who had gotten relief from deportation, but also importantly, the ability to go to school and to work. And so what happened yesterday was an attempt by Congress, and especially in the Senate, to find something that would provide a fix. Now, the big controversies arose in terms of what other conditions would be attached to it. The bipartisan bill that got the most support would have added funding for border enforcement, so it had two components to it, whereas President Trump was insisting on even more restrictions, including restrictions on legal immigration moving forward. And that got a lot less support. In fact, it didn't even get a majority of support in the Senate, including many of President Trump's Republican colleagues.
So where are DACA recipients now? The courts have blocked implementation of it, but that's not a done deal. What happens next now if Congress doesn't get together on a solution here?
Absolutely. Well, the courts have blocked the expiration of DACA, right? So DACA is still moving along, and the White House is looking to appeal the court's the district court's decision all the way up to the Supreme Court, but that will probably take at least a couple of months to resolve. So in the meantime, those who qualify for DACA will still be able to renew their applications pending resolution by the courts. But what it does is it just leads to a lot of anxiety and uncertainty, and especially for not only for immigrant populations, but also organizations that either employ them or have them as students, right? It creates a lot of uncertainty and anxiety in terms of what will happen to these kids if this program does indeed expire.
If the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, ultimately does let President Trump's order ending DACA go through, does that mean all the people who are brought over into the country illegally as youth, they would be subject to deportation at that point?
Absolutely. It would also mean that they would immediately lose their ability to work. In many states, they would lose access to things like going to college or qualifying for financial aid. It would cause havoc, not only to our economy, but to many institutions where DACA beneficiaries currently work as employees or attend as students. It would also have implications for DACA members who currently serve in the U.S. military. They would no longer be able to work in the U.S. military or as teachers and in other public services.
Karthik Ramakrishnan is with us from the University of California, Riverside. We're looking at immigration, DACA, and the U.S. Senate yesterday, where four separate immigration proposals were ultimately rejected in Senate votes. Karthik, a lot of public opinion polls have shown the public at large is in favor of keeping the DACA recipients in the country, coming up with some kind of solution. The president himself has said at various points he wants Congress to come up with something that keeps them here. A lot of people across the aisle have said this, yet it seems like it's really hard to arrive at a political agreement on this. Why is that?
Yeah, in fact, if you look at then-candidate President Trump has consistently had a soft spot, if you will, according to the perspective of some immigration conservatives, but he's consistently held that there has to be some solution for so-called dreamers, the way he puts it, right? And where the struggle comes in is within the White House itself, there's a tug of war between the likes of Steve Miller and Kelly, Chief of Staff Kelly, and the president. Miller and Kelly have more hardline positions on immigration and are trying to use this moment to cut back on various aspects of immigration, including legal immigration to the United States, with cuts to family visas. So if this were a clean decision just on the DREAM Act or DACA, or if it was a decision that paired DACA with a border wall solution, we would have a bill that would be signed by the president. But the president added additional conditions on the urging of immigration conservatives within the White House and in the U.S. Senate, like Senator Cotton.
And there was a bill in the Senate, as I understand it, that was pretty close to what the White House is looking for, and that got the fewest votes. I think it was 39 in the Senate of any of those four proposals.
Absolutely. But one thing I should note is that even that common sense coalition bill that had only provisions on DACA and the border wall and border security, that was something that President Trump said that he was comfortable with less than six months ago when he met with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. These new additions on cuts to legal immigration is something that's been added over the past couple of months, and that failed spectacularly in the Senate. It got just about 40 votes in the Senate, nowhere near the 54 votes that this common sense coalition measure got in the Senate yesterday.
Now the Senate is done with immigration, at least for the moment. The House is expected, I think, to take up some kind of vote. What are you watching for to happen next after the failure of these four different plans in the Senate?
I think there's a lot of action that's going to be happening in the courts. But I think what we're also going to look for is to see what the American public does. People strongly support a solution to the issue of DACA, to the issue of Dreamers. But the question is, are they going to put any pressure on their elected officials? Those who are affected by the program are certainly doing as much as they can to put pressure on Republicans as well as Democrats to find a solution. But I think public opinion and public support needs to be activated in a much bigger way. And we'll see if that happens. I think images of well, maybe not images, but if there are thousands of recipients who lose their employment status, I think you'll see a lot more concern being expressed and pressure to act in Washington.
Karthik, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Karthik Ramakrishnan is a professor of public policy and political science at the University of California, Riverside. He joined us to talk about immigration and where Congress goes from here after the Senate failed to pass any reform plan yesterday. Right now, the business of buying and selling social media followers, especially on Twitter, is a hot topic. A recent New York Times piece revealed some celebrities, businesses, and others who have bought followers from companies. Many of the followers for sale, though, aren't really people. They're bots, some with profiles based on real user info. Beyond the worry of stolen identity and faked popularity is an even bigger question. Why do so many people care about their numbers? Is how many followers you have really that influential on your success? Steve Knoll is a marketing and social media instructor at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Cool. Thanks for having me again.
Well, fake followers, what are they and why can we buy them?
So what they are, these are basically accounts that have been set up either using a fictional name or in a lot of cases, they've gone out and copied profiles. So it's actually a real person's name with their actual picture, but it's not them. And then these companies can go out and sell them to people for literally, you know, pennies per follower or like. So they can really help boost up a business or somebody who's really trying to show online credibility by having a large number of followers.
And that New York Times piece I mentioned followed one young woman, a real human, from the Midwest, I think.
I believe she was from Minnesota.
And she had a real name and a real profile. And they copied that picture of her, same tagline. But all of a sudden, she's tweeting stuff for businesses. She's tweeting in languages she doesn't speak, this other
She was 17 at the time. And she was actually being used to sell direct traffic to porn sites.
Right.
So she's 19 now. But at the time when this all started, she was underage.
Why, if I'm a business or a celebrity, why do I want a fake follower? What good does that do me?
A lot of it is it's credibility. It's for example, if there was a company in Wisconsin that made homemade soap and they wanted to sell it to people through their website, they could find a local blogger that writes about like organic and homemade products, and they could say, "Hey, would you send out a message on my account?" Kind of endorsing me, and they would say, "Sure, I've got 100,000 followers. The going rate for about 100,000 followers is $2,000. So if you pay me $2,000, I will send out a message promoting your soap." So, you know, you would do it, and then of course the message would go out. Whether or not of those 100,000 followers, the big question is how many of them are real, honest followers? How many of them are artificial?
And I've heard cases of, hey, somebody's trying to sell a book to a publisher. That publisher says, "Oh, you only have 800 followers?
Sure.
Oh, you've got 10,000 followers.
Well, yeah. You must be credible if all these people are following you." And that's herein lies the quandary, because buying followers is not illegal. It is, and it's not. But it's not unillegal. It's you know, in the digital wild west we're in now, there's all these new things coming up, and the law moves so slow, we don't have a chance to really kind of establish law. So it's very much a gray area we're in.
Officially, I understand it, a place like Twitter says, you can't do this. You can't sell accounts.
Correct.
You can't make up accounts and sell them.
But they've also said that as many as 10 or 15% of all Twitter accounts are fake. Facebook has also said, yes, some of our accounts are fake. They claim it's under that figure, but other people have said both Facebook and Twitter, about 10 or 15% of the accounts are not real accounts.
And from a social media website's perspective, they want to have a big number of total users.
Yep, for sure.
Maybe they don't want to be too vigilant about cracking down on that.
Well, and that's kind of the irony. The other thing, too, is, people, the public who may be, mad about this, human beings say one thing and do another thing all the time. And Facebook kind of got their hands slapped a couple years ago when they were kind of saying, okay, we're going to kind of crack down on fake account. From now on, you have to use your real name on your account so we can verify you're real. And a lot of people, there was a huge outcry against doing that because people said, oh, I don't want to use my real name on Facebook. So you have people on one hand saying, oh, yeah, Facebook needs to do more, or Twitter needs to do more. But on the other hand, there are people saying, yeah, but as long as it doesn't impact me personally. So these big media companies are really kind of stuck in the middle of trying to do the right thing.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College about fake followers on social media, followers for sale if you want to buy them to inflate your numbers. Steve, we hadn't planned on talking about this today, but news broke today, indictments against Russians for election interference and lots of fake accounts. To tell us what happened there.
So basically what they're saying is that, yes, they have now been able to identify Russian nationalists, people in the country that have been working with a country, actually a company out of Florida that was basically buying and setting up fake accounts and then propagating and spreading either fake news or real news with a very, you know, left or right angle to it. Because there's a difference between fake news and opinion news. So big difference there. Everyone calls it fake news, but there's more to it than that. In fact, we just saw it even today. There's been a large spike in these accounts. See, we know who these fake accounts are, some of them at least, and they're being monitored. And they even saw today a large spike in messages going out on gun control with the recent school shooting. So some of them are going out and, you know, hyping up the, you know, Second Amendment, you know, but then other ones are saying, no, gun control. Because the whole idea is just to make everybody on both sides a lot more angry and inflamed so we keep fighting with each other. This has been a big campaign that the Russian government has been, it's been implied that they've been doing. Today's indictments show there actually is now a legal court case for it.
And it's not just gun control the last 2 days.
Correct.
This is, they've been playing kind of both sides of a lot of
They've been
issues.
Playing this for a long time. It has been known that they've really been using it to you know, help Trump and hurt Clinton in the election. That's well known. But certainly these you know, Russian bots, and really a lot of these anonymous or fake bots have really been out there. They're really, you know, do you want to go to the left? Do you want to go to the right? Just they'll take whatever opinion you want. You just write them a check, and they'll put out opinions one way or the other.
Or buy my soap.
Or buy your soap. Yes, correct.
So what is a user to do, right? You're on Facebook. Oh, there's a picture of the grandkids.
Right,
somebody just got married, whatever. Oh, here's this inflammatory news article.
Well, what I always tell people is if you see something on Facebook that immediately triggers an emotion, especially anger, or a story that says, aha, that's exactly what I thought. Here's proof that this person's awful. Right then and there, that should be a sign that this is probably made up. And it's. I always tell people, think before you click, you know, or share. That's the thing is, though, people on both the left and right equally are sharing this stuff without thinking. They're both to blame. And that's part of it is, you know, when you get a friend request on Facebook, you got to verify, do you know this person? You know, a lot of times I've been amazed how many friends, you know, I'll get a friend request on Facebook and it says, this person knows three of your friends. And I'll look at that friend request and go, oh, this is so obviously fake. I can kind of see through it. And I've contacted my friends and I'm like, do you know this person? They're like, no, they friended me and I just accepted it. And I'm like, they're fake. That's a bot. You've got to delete that. What if they're a real person? Trust me, they're not.
Well, but often you'll see that story. And I've seen this in my own family from both ends of the political perspective. An actual fake news story, something made up, supporting one side or the other.
Yeah, the Pope endorsing Trump was a fake news story.
Right.
That's a real fake news story.
So stories like that coming from family members, I know it's them. So how do we come up with some kind of hygiene, some kind of etiquette to track that back?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, though, I've mentioned that to people to followers or friends of mine. I've said, hey, do you realize this is a fake story? And it seems like then I get in trouble for being
right.
The bad
you're on the other side.
Yes, and I've had numerous friends of mine who have openly criticized me for being one of them. And so I just
open your eyes, man.
Yeah, I just don't say. I know who these people are, and I'm just like, you know, I just don't say anything. But part of that is, I mean, if it's dangerous, I certainly will. I will text someone and say, did you just friend me? Because we're already friends and things like that. It's kind of like, oh, I didn't know that. Maybe I was hacked. And I'm like, yeah, you need to look into this because your picture's there. And the only reason I knew it wasn't you is because this picture was from 3 years ago. And I know you changed your hair or something like that. So that's little things like that to be on the lookout is just a real safe way of kind of protecting yourself.
Bringing things back to where we started with these fake followers and this value on the numbers of our followers, whether we're a celebrity or a business or whatever.
Yep.
I mean, it's a number.
It is a number.
We love numbers. Yeah. We love metrics. It proves our success. Are we, especially with this Times article and other exposés on this,
it translates to dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we going to start to move away from looking at this and saying, oh, yeah, that's a valid metric of how successful you are.
Yes and no. I think we will eventually, but this whole thing of digital marketing is still a relatively new frontier. You know, you think about Facebook and Twitter as true business tools. They've really been around for 10 years, where we had how many years for radio and television and billboards and newspapers and all that. I think that eventually, yes, we will get to more insightful and more things that are like about intent and emotion besides just a series of numbers. But I think we're probably still 5 or 10 years away from that technology really being comfortable. You know, we still look at like Nielsen and Arbitron for ratings numbers, even though these numbers are still statistically very flawed, but it's the only system that's out there. So I think that, you know, we're kind of in weird areas, and we're just going to have to be there for a while and try to do some other stuff on the grassroots level.
But by the time we figure out how to deal with Facebook and Twitter numbers, who's going to care about Facebook and Twitter? It's going to be something else and something else.
And it's not just Facebook and Twitter. That's the thing is, though, all these fake followers and fake bots, they're on Snapchat, Instagram, everything. It's not just, you know, Facebook and Twitter are you know, the big machines. So they're the ones that get all the blame. But really, it's anything. You know, there's an expression that says, if it's free, you're the product. So your Snapchat was free, your Instagram was free, your Twitter's free. So therefore, these companies are mining you for your data. And it is. It's very, very valuable. You know, and that's the given number is 100,000 followers is worth $2,000.
We'll leave it there for now, Steve. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me again.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing and social media professor at Madison College. He joined us to talk about fake followers on social media. You can share your thoughts with us when you follow us on Twitter at Central Time WPR, but not if you're a robot. First, it's Food Friday. Winter is still with us in Wisconsin, and one of the best comfort foods during the cold weather is a hearty bowl of soup. Lori Skelton is with us for a look at what makes a great winter soup. We'll learn how to make some traditional Czech and Moroccan soups along the way. And we want to hear about your favorites at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to soup recipe, especially during the winter? Do you put your own spin on any cold weather classics? What questions do you have about making soup? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori Skelton is a classical music host at WPR and an in-house foodie here. Lori, welcome back.
So how much time do we have?
Yeah, we could take forever on soup, right?
Good Lord, yes. When I put this up on my own personal Facebook post, you know, I'm trying a few ways to make winter soups a little more interesting. Anybody got any ideas? I got inundated. And I got inundated with everything from Iraqi bean soup to a lentil puree that dates from the Middle Ages.
Wow.
Yeah, everybody's got a favorite. Everybody's got something they gravitate to, especially at this time of year. There is something comforting about the process of making soup. The idea that I've got something gently simmering on the stove just makes you feel like you're taking care of your home, you're taking care of yourself. And especially for me, the more like onions and garlic and things, I definitely know I'm taking care of my health, mostly because my coworkers will stay a good 20 feet away from me after I've had a bowl of garlic soup.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that is the lovely thing about soup. Everybody has their favorite, and yet when you gave me this assignment, my initial thought was, oh, come on, what don't we already know about soup? And I actually had surprises putting some of these recipes together, which was delightful to know that you can still be surprised by something as basic as a soup.
Right. Well, I think that's the great thing about soup is you can take it in so many directions. And like a lot of times I'll start making soup. I don't know what kind of soup it's going to be. Like I'll start frying up carrots and onions and garlic. And then along the way, oh, I've got some leftover pulled chicken in the fridge, or leftover this veggie. Oh, hey, here's a thing of squash I froze back in the fall. You can throw in lots of stuff and make it up along the way.
And you bring up a good point of the idea that there's something about soup that takes everything, all the bits and bobs in the kitchen, and puts it all together. And if you're a really smart cook, you'll have bags in the freezer, one for bones if you're a meat eater, and always one for vegetable scraps so that you can always, if not sit down and make a from-scratch stock, have a little something extra to add to the pot.
Yeah, you're a big fan of making your own stock. I'll do a halfway thing. Like, I'll save my old pasta water. I'll boil down, the rotisserie chicken remnants to get a start on a stock. But then I'll still use, there's those glops you can buy, like bouillon, but better than, if I can give away the brand name I go to. There are others.
Hey, I've got a jar of that in my refrigerator as well. That said, if you can get yourself on the track to save scraps and then sit down once a month and make a stock, it really does make a difference. There are a couple of things you need to keep in mind, but once you've got that in your kitchen repertoire, you can kind of put yourself on autopilot. When you're making a stock, especially a vegetable stock, you want things with savory flavors, but not so strong that they're going to overpower everything. You brought up the classic onion, carrot, celery. It's called a mirepoix, and that's how a lot of soups throughout Europe get started. In Asian countries, the version is often garlic, scallion, and ginger that gets sautéed to get started. If you're going to be adding things like bell peppers or mushrooms to your stock, those are vegetables that benefit from either being roasted ahead of time or very, very lightly sautéed. Again, if you've got the time to roast vegetables beforehand, before throwing into the pot with water, that is going to make a really great stock.
And something I've experimented with, I'll roast cauliflower in advance, or I've done this a couple times lately and I love it. Onions and garlic I roast in the oven, if I have time. Mm-hmm. I roast in the oven first with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and that just brings out a whole nother flavor.
Now, let me ask you this. With roasted cauliflower, are you adding that to stock, or are you just pureeing that immediately to make a creamy cauliflower soup?
I'm adding that to the soup as it's going. Yes,
okay.
There's still chunks.
Okay, because if you're working on a vegetable stock rather than a soup, if you're working on something that is going to be bubbling very, very slowly for a couple of hours on your stove to make a stock, brassicas, broccoli, cauliflower, collard greens, kohlrabi, bok choy, turnips, cabbage will end up turning bitter.
Yeah.
If you have vegetable stock already made, you can take brassicas and add them to your finished soup maybe 20 minutes before you're done.
That's what I do, yeah.
But you do need to be careful. Not every vegetable is going to make a great stock. You'd think potatoes, don't we all love a good potato soup? You'd think potatoes would be a natural for stock. Potatoes don't add a lot of flavor. They're going to add some body, but they're also going to make that stock cloudy. Potato peels, a few is nice. It'll add an earthy texture. But again, potatoes, things like zucchini, even some green beans, you boil them for a long time, they're going to get bitter. So you do need to be careful. Not every vegetable can go into a stock. Every vegetable can go into a soup.
Right.
But give yourself a little bit of care when making that stock.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about soup with our own Lori Skelton. And Lori, let's get to one of your recipes. You brought in a harira soup. This is a traditional Moroccan soup. It's got the lentils, the chickpeas, and other stuff. Tell us about this one.
This was a surprise. It's come up. The most recent version I found was in the recent version of Cooks Illustrated. What I found is that harira is a North African soup. It's very often eaten during Ramadan to break your fast at the end of the day. And there are as many versions of this as there are cooks. It's kind of like the Moroccan version of chicken soup. You can use fava beans in addition to or instead of the chickpeas and lentils. You can use rice in it instead of pasta. Apparently, the original version was using lamb and lamb broth, but the version that I was working off of started with the idea we want to make this easy, we're going to make it vegetarian. And of course, if you're using rice instead of pasta, that will even make it vegan. Some cooks in Africa will thicken the soup with some beaten egg. Some people will actually add hard-boiled eggs as garnish when they're serving it. I made a couple of different versions of this, and there was one morning that I had the soup for breakfast, and I poached an egg in the soup.
Wow.
It was amazing. And this is the recipe that we have online, right? And so we have olive oil, onions, celery ribs. This soup calls for Swiss chard leaves to be put in at the end, and I thought, yes, the leaves are lovely, but those stems chopped up with the celery made another great base for the soup. Fresh ginger, although you can use ground. I put a suggestion if you want to. There's coriander in there, smoked paprika, cumin, ground cinnamon. Great warm spice. Yeah, we normally think of cinnamon as something sweet for dessert, but cinnamon adds a great depth to a lot of savory dishes. Red pepper flakes. It uses a fair amount of fresh cilantro and fresh parsley, this particular recipe. If you don't like cilantro, there are other greens that you can use. And again, add them at the end so the soup doesn't get bitter.
One of the lessons I've learned there, I've wasted in the past a lot of great fresh green herbs by putting them in way too early, and then they get killed,
and or they'll just get limp and gray.
Yeah.
And there isn't a you do have to eat with your eyes. There is something about that aesthetic as well. One of the lovely things about the version of Harira that I've got online is that it uses brown lentils, which cook up very quickly without needing to be soaked ahead of time, and it uses canned chickpeas, which got everybody on 7th floor talking. Do you use canned peas or beans when you're making a soup, or is it worth the trouble to get the dried variety, soak them overnight, and then use those beans as well? I will be honest, I haven't decided is one way better than the other. It seems to be kind of in terms of what is the recipe calling for, but I will bet you if we turn that question over to anyone listening, everybody's got his or her own preferred method of using a dried bean or legume in a soup.
Again, you can find that recipe for Harira soup on WPR.org/Food Friday or the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori Skelton is with us for Food Friday. We're talking about hearty winter soups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your number one favorite soup to cook and or eat during the winter? What advice do you have for aspiring soup makers? If you make heartier soups with beans or chickpeas, do you, to get to Lori's question, do you use dried beans or go with canned beans? I'm lazy and I don't plan. I do canned beans usually. What questions do you have about making a great comforting soup? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and again find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. WPR's own Lori Skelton is with us for Food Friday. We are making soup today. And we could take your tips and questions at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorite soup for the cold weather. What kind of spices and seasonings you always keep on hand for soup? Do you need questions or do you have some advice of your own? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'll go to your calls now. Cheryl is with us in Conover. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Cheryl?
Well, first of all, the first rule of soup is never throw anything away that can be boiled down to make a broth.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. And number two is my favorite one is a Southwest chicken soup where I cook chicken and I shred it, and it's corn and black beans and pinto beans and Rotel tomatoes and regular tomatoes. And it's all based on a base from the turkey carcass from Thanksgiving. So, being raised by a grandmother, and I'm 65 now, and a grandmother, you do not throw those away.
No.
You cook them until you get the broth, and then you can freeze it for up to a year as a soup starter.
Ah,
fantastic, Cheryl.
I have two freezers full of soup starter.
I've got one question. When you're actually putting the soup together, when you're getting down to your beans, at the finish, I don't think you'd put this in your starter, but at your finished soup, do you ever put any kind of acid in, like a lime juice or a little bit of vinegar?
You know, that's a good question, because I've been starting to play with balsamic vinegar lately.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when I do the broth is just plain with bay leaves, and then I strain it and put it in the freezer.
Nice.
Okay. This is something that surprised me when I was making the harira. Fairly spicy soup, and yet the last thing it calls for is a couple of tablespoons of lemon juice. Now, I tasted the soup before I added the lemon juice and thought, you know, I'm not really getting the heat from the smoked paprika and the pepper flakes. I added the lemon juice, and suddenly the soup just sang. I've come to the conclusion, especially when you're working with beans or lentils or legumes of any sort, that you're gonna need a little bit of acid to bring out all the flavors that come in that soup.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that call. I came to the same discovery not that long ago. I'd had soup at my favorite Mediterranean restaurant back in Michigan, and it was very lemony. I found a recipe online that, yeah, you juice half a lemon and add that right at the end. And the before and after was, like you say, it was incredible.
And I was asking a lot of people, is this something that you sort of do? And then one of the people on Seventh Floor Vilas, one of the people who works in the background here at Wisconsin Public Radio, said, well, now that you mention it, my dad always puts dill pickle juice on his black beans.
Oh, okay.
So apparently there is something about the starch that really seems to call for a little bit of acid. So if you're making a soup, especially if it has beans or chickpeas or lentils in it, and you're thinking it's tasting a little bland, don't necessarily go for more salt and pepper. Try some acid first.
Let's go to another caller now. Jake is with us in Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What do you want to tell us about, Jake?
Well, after marrying my wife, and she was a pescatarian, I had to change a lot of the way I did things.
So hold on, that's a vegetarian who also eats fish. Do I have that right, Jake?
That is correct.
Okay, go for it.
Trying a whole bunch of food, trying to our hands at a whole bunch of foods from around the world, especially soups, my secret ingredient that I can add to just about any clear broth soup and have it add a layer that we really like is oregano.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just want to share with anybody who doesn't know, there is a tomato bouillon that is out there in most grocery stores that adds a somewhat tangy stock if you're pressed for time that we all really enjoy.
And Jake, let me ask you about how you use the oregano. Are you going dried or fresh or both?
Dried. I add that near the beginning, and it lends its flavor to the entire broth. Although at the end, we do end up like putting fresh parsley and fresh cilantro in a lot of our soups.
And,
but for the oregano, I like it at the beginning.
And you're finding oregano is a really good pair with fish soups.
For fish soups, bean soups, just about anything with a clear broth.
Okay.
Jake, thanks a lot.
Love
and
it.
That's the opposite of the rule I learned with fresh herbs, right? If you're using the dried herbs, get them in there earlier.
Very often they are going to need a little bit more heat and agitation to come up to their full flavor, yes.
Jake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lori Skelton, it's Food Friday. We're cooking soup. And Lori, another recipe that you have up, another experiment you brought in for us, a traditional Czech soup. I had legumes and dried, this kind of surprised me a little bit, dried fruit in it.
This comes from the wonderful book from the State Historical Society, The Flavor of Wisconsin, An Informal History of Food and Eating in the Badger State. Fruited bean soup. This recipe was submitted from a woman in Kenosha who said that her mother grew her own pinto beans. This was one of the family's favorite winter soups. Could not be simpler. Cup of dried pinto beans, cup of dried prunes, a cup of dried apples or pears, a cup of potato in 1-inch cubes, salt, and then you make a roux with butter and flour and water. I'm looking at this thinking, well, you can tell our pioneer forebears were really of hearty stock because this has got to be so bland tasting. Oh boy, was I wrong. Oh boy. And now here's one instance where dried beans made a difference because this did need to simmer for a couple of hours. And it was just the beans simmering even after they had been soaking overnight. Hour and a half of simmering beans, you start throwing in the prunes, the dried apples, and suddenly you've got this amazing thick broth. The prunes were not too sweet. The apples brought this lovely texture to everything. You've got comforting cubes of potato and beans. And all it needed was salt. It didn't need anything else. I was absolutely blown away by how simple and how good this was. So I guess our Czech forebears, well, somebody's Czech forebears really knew what they were doing.
Now, I was at a training that day, so I missed this soup. And I'll say, Lori, I've thrown a lot of things into soups before. I don't think I have ever once thought to reach for dried fruit. I think raisins with lentils, but not in a soup. But this works.
This worked brilliantly. I was expecting everybody to take a polite bite or two and then say, yeah, interesting experiment. But no, that pot was gone in an hour. And somebody on the Central Time or the Ideas Network Facebook page sent us a link to Ina Garten's curried butternut squash soup recipe where she garnishes it with scallions, shredded coconut, chopped cashews, and diced banana.
Sounds like a great Sunday except for the soup.
So fruit is not an odd option, especially if you want to bring out something sweeter. Throw in a little bit of apple or pear and see what happens.
I want to bring on another caller. Mary is on the line in Alma. Mary, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm up to my elbows making chicken and dumplings, and my question is, every time I roast a chicken or boil a chicken in a pot, and then I want to make a chicken stock, it always gels. I was wondering if there's a secret to try to get chicken stock that's like chicken stock in a box that's liquid and not gels after you've put it in the refrigerator.
After you've put it in the refrigerator and you've tried skimming it?
Yes.
Okay. You're getting into Culinary Institute of America territory that I frankly have not mastered. This is where you will have to clarify a soup by putting in another kind of protein. Egg whites sometimes work, or sometimes a little bit of chopped raw meat. It's called a raft. And what you do is you gently boil that cloudy stock with whipped egg whites or raw meat sitting on top of the stock, and it acts as a filter to clear that stock up. The CIA's standard is you should be able to read the date on a dime at the bottom of your stock pot when you're done. That said, it's not something that I can do at will. I've tried it. I've been successful half the time. This is one thing you should Google. I know there are videos online about how to clarify a stock using a raft of another protein. It's going to take some practice, but boy, if you can manage that, you are literally cooking with gas. It's great to have that skill.
Good luck, Mary. I'm going to live with a gel myself. Lori, do you have just really briefly a next soup you want to try to make now?
The next soup I'm going to be making, since I don't have to worry next week about standing in a chorus of 150 people as I'm going to be doing tonight, I'm going to be going back to garlic soups, especially things with saffron and a little bit of tomato. I am trying to ward off a cold, and alliums are the way to go.
Lori, thanks as always. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and an in-house foodie. She was with us to talk on Food Friday about soup. You can find a couple of the recipes she shared at WPR.org/Food Friday or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got soup suggestions there from Whitney, Kathleen, and Chris as well. And you can share your favorite recipes. Hey, send us a picture of a soup you have just made. Say you're looking through a used book you just got, settling in to read it, and a lock of hair falls out. Ew, right? Okay, but what if it's George Washington's hair? This happened, as reported in the Smithsonian Magazine. An archivist, never know, at Union College in New York State was going through an old book, The Gaines Universal Register, or American and British Calendar for the Year 1793. A gripping read, I'm sure. The book was apparently from the collection of General Philip Schuyler, who was a friend of George Washington's. So this archive person is going through the book, and there's an envelope with some hair in it, and it's labeled Washington's hair, and it lists the provenance, who it was given by, and so on. Researchers, they're pretty convinced that it's the real deal from the head of the founding father, but they can't DNA test it without destroying it. So we may never know 100% for sure. They say, you look at a picture of George Washington, a portrait, yeah, that hair would fit in pretty good. So next time you're reading that used sci-fi paperback or Grisham novel and you find some hair in it, still probably throw the hair out. It can just about guarantee it's not George Washington's. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.